Beer, Cheese, and Murder is a true crime podcast about Wisconsin from Wisconsin. Due to the nature of true crime, this podcast contains explicit and graphic content which may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. I'm Erica, and joining me on this lovely daytime recording are...
Bonnie,
Dina,
Jill,
and Terry.
It's actually been a while since we've done this during the daylight hours.
Like months and months.
Sundays are saved for football.
Yeah.
But it's a bye week.
Well, I think they had a game on Thursday.
Yeah,
none
that I care about.
Well,
well, today.
Seems like it's not the right season to be a Packer fan.
Oh, or a Badger fan.
I guess technically I am, but I don't really pay attention. So maybe that makes me a poser. I don't know. But all right. So... Dina, I believe you've got some stuff to share with us for food and beverage. So what do you have?
Yeah. So, like I said, Sundays, normally I am sitting at the bar, Left's Lucky Town, all day, drinking beer, watching my football, sometimes having some bar food. It's my spot. And since we've got a bye week, I thought it's the week of Thanksgiving as we're recording. If there's going to be a day where I can just say, screw it, calories, I thought today was probably a pretty good day to do that, especially since I'm not drinking like 10 beers today. So I got some Oscar's custard. I ran out and got some this morning and got their flavor of the day,
which is
butter pecan.
I had never had it before, actually. So it's called Badger Claw.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Ribbons of hard shell chocolate and roasted pecans swirled into caramel custard, and I took a few bites.
It's
amazing. Like, I'm shocked at how good it is. It might be one of my favorite custards that I've ever had. It's really, really, really good.
Oh, my gosh. That's today you went this morning?
That's today.
I'm picking
Oscars in West Dallas.
I think all the locations of Oscars have the same flavor of the day, regardless
of
where
you go. Like it,
if you go to Franklin, it should still be the same. But yeah, no, I've definitely had that before. I think that's one of their ones that they're known for, especially. It's been
ages since I've gone into Oscars. I've asked it a million times. I know it's good. I just don't really eat out that often, and I rarely let myself get custard or ice cream because I love it. And I will eat the whole thing, but so I got a little pint today, and it's amazing. So I'm gonna try to eat it a little bit throughout the day and a little bit tomorrow to hopefully make it a couple of days and not finish it all at once.
Yeah, for future reference, they got good fried cheese curds too.
They do have very good fried cheese curds.
Never had those there. What about onion rings?
I think so. They have onion rings. I don't know that we usually.
Their burgers are good. Their food is good in general. It smelled amazing in there.
Yeah. I mean, it's good.
Sorry.
I was going to say, it's on a level with Cops. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm just looking up because I'll be out in Waukesha this afternoon for basketball games, and there's one in Waukesha.
So nice.
I may make a little side trip there. It's thank you.
Very, very good. So to go along with that, because I already knew what my drink was going to be, and so I was trying to think of something sweet to go with my drink because salty would not go with what I have. So I decided it's kind of Christmas season-y, and I'm going to be putting my tree up today since I'm going to be out of town during the time that I would normally put it up after Thanksgiving. So since I'm doing a little Christmas day today, I have some Tippy Cow rum cream, and I mixed that with some Travis Haas cow pie. So they're two like creamy liqueurs, and it's, I have it on ice. It's delicious. The Tippy Cow, I have a Shamrock Mint. And Tippy Cow is out of Pewaukee, Wisconsin. And it's amazing. They got a whole bunch of different flavors. The Shamrock Mint is delish. You can do now, it as a shot or on ice.
That's not the same manufacturer of Rum Chata, is it? Because they're out of Pewaukee.
I don't know. Is that out of Midwest Custom Bottling? Well, that's where it's bottled. I know it's made in Wisconsin. Is it bottled at the same place that it's made? I would think it would have to be, right? That makes sense.
I think. Yeah. Huh. So Midwest Custom Bottling. I was just curious. Bottling. Like, wow.
Pewaukee. Another
Wisconsin liqueur place in Pewaukee.
And then this Travis Haas Cow Pie. It's the flavor, it's a liqueur. It's 30 proof. It's chocolate caramel vanilla.
Ooh.
Oh my. And it's Wisconsin dairy cream and rum. But it, to me, actually tastes like it's got a little bit of nutty flavor to it. So it actually tasted really good with the pecans from the custard. And this is from the Dancing Goat Distillery in Cambridge.
That sounds amazing. Yeah,
really good. So again, like I know that I've had this, but I would not have known that it was a Wisconsin product. So per usual, I went on to the Total Wine and More website and just put Wisconsin and then narrowed it down to spirits and went through them and found this cow pie. And I already had the Tippy Cow, so got a little like chocolate mint mix.
I feel like that Tippy Cow would be good for some grasshoppers.
Yeah.
Ooh,
it
yeah.
basically tastes like a grasshopper, even just on ice. Mm. Very good.
I like your cup too. Hopefully yes, that'll
so
be
that's on, compliments of my friend Karen for my 50th birthday.
Love that.
All right. I have, and it'll be in the picture that I post, which I got your picture also. So make sure that's included. I have some maple wine from the Door Peninsula Winery, which we like to highlight on this podcast quite frequently. And they're out of Sturgeon Bay in Door County, Wisconsin, and it's 11.5% ABV. So think of it more as like kind of like a port wine, in that it's more of like a sipper and more of like a dessert wine.
Is that why it's in a different shape bottle?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They're taller, like, skinnier when they're not like a normal, like,
skinnier. Yep. And taller. It's like it's a limited edition or a limited blend or whatever that they have as well. And then although unlike a port, it's actually intended to be served chilled. So it said like best served ice cold. So there's that. And then it says, on their website, it says made from 100% Door County maple syrup, just like a mead is made from honey. Similar in character to an ice wine, maple wine is very sweet and best served ice cold. Try it over ice cream. So definitely don't need like a big glass. Like I said, more of like a dessert wine for sure.
Yeah.
Probably not over the Oscar's Badger Claw though. Yeah. Might be a little too much.
I would go for some vanilla ice cream.
Yes.
So, and then as you were going through what you're eating and drinking, I scarfed on my lunch/breakfast, which is I made myself a grilled cheese sandwich. And so I actually used two different kinds of cheese in it. So I used some Sargento Creamery cheddar. And so Sargento Foods is definitely a lot more mainstream commercial brand, but it is out of Wisconsin. So it's out of Plymouth, Wisconsin. And the creamery cheese in particular, it says, our simple addition of real cream brings an amazing melt and smooth cheesiness to our creamery, 100% real natural cheddar and Swiss cheese. You'll love the melty deliciousness on all your favorite sandwiches and burgers. It's the creamy melt you crave. So I specifically, again, use the cheddar. So I like my grilled cheese with cheddar. And then I also added to that some of the Gardner's aged Gouda cheese.
That sounds good.
It was actually a very good combo. And the Gouda is a little bit softer than that cheddar. And so that was cheese that I had actually in the episode I just posted last night, two episodes ago. So it's Gardner's Wisconsin Cheese and Sausage is the company where that's from, out of Loyal, Wisconsin. And those were some of the cheeses that I got from my my employees when for Boss's Day. So used some of that in there, and it was delicious. Went down very nice.
Ooh, actually, speaking of that, like a gift, I should probably, if my firm does it again this year, they sent us, or gave us all, but since most of us weren't in the office, they actually shipped it to us, a box of a bunch of different Wisconsin products last year. They do all everything, you know, as much local as possible around the Milwaukee area. But that's where I had like local honey and pretzels and cheese and sausage and all this stuff. So maybe they'll do that again this year. And then I'll get to try some other new products from companies I hadn't yet heard of.
Yeah, it'll be good stuff for sure. Stuff we can highlight. Yeah. So anybody else with any Wisconsin food or beverage before we move into our Wisco fact? All right. So I actually have a book for our Wisco fact today. So last weekend, my parents took the kids on Saturday to Train Fest. And so I went to the mall, as one does. But actually, I was running errands and getting some Christmas gifts. But I stopped in Renaissance Bookstore. And this was like right as I walked in is a book that says Weird Wisconsin. So, of course, I had to get it. So it's Weird Wisconsin, your travel guide to Wisconsin's local legends and best kept secrets. So the little snippet from this book that I'm going to share for Wisco Fact today is that there once was a worm shower in Palmyra in 1897.
Worm shower, like where it rained worms?
Yep.
What?
Oh, yeah. So it says things fall from Wisconsin skies with alarming regularity. Most of us are familiar with rain, hail, snow, and the various incarnations of water. However, some falling objects don't conform to usual expectations and are totally unpredictable. If you were lucky enough to live in Palmyra in 1897, you would have seen this headline in the Enterprise newspaper on Thursday, April 29th, a shower of worms. Early risers several days before, on Friday, April 23rd, had found the ground beneath their feet covered with worms. They were everywhere, crawling in the dirt, crawling in tubs set out to catch rainwater, crawling in pans full of chicken and animal feed. According to the Enterprise, the worms on examination proved to differ from our native angleworm, and Captain McDonald, an expert fisherman as well as gardener, declared them to be gilt-edged, so named because of yellow or golden spots or yellow rings on the end of the worm. McDonald claimed expertise because he had used the exact worms to catch trout in Ireland. The newspaper article continued, "The question arises, where did they come from? Did they drift in a cloud across the deep blue sea?" Alas, no one responded to this inquiry. The mystery of the worm's origin was never solved, and within a short time, they had all disappeared into the earth.
Yuck.
Wow. Well, thank goodness they disappeared.
Well, it's like in the dirt, yeah.
They burrowed into the dirt.
Well, yeah. Right. I mean, like, not like they stayed there and you were, like, walking.
Well, I would assume that if they were, in fact, not native, that they've been here long enough now that they're native now.
Native now, yeah.
So I have to make a comment. Lucky Dina wasn't 4 years old then. In 1897. Dina, your worm story.
I was... three, not
okay,
four.
Well, three. Share the story. That it's a good one.
I don't think Dina agrees.
Dina's rolling her eyes at me, listeners.
All right. It's like my mom's favorite freaking story about me to tell. When I was 3 years old, we lived in Oshkosh. It was right before we moved to Madison. And a little three-year-old Dina walked up to the door. And the way that my mom tells it is this. I ring the doorbell. She comes to the door and I'm standing there chewing.
Oh no.
And she says, what are you doing? And I said, Mom, can I have a drink of water? And she's like, sure. What are you eating? And as I'm chewing, I'm like, a worm. She said she looked at me and her eyes got big. And then she could see that I kind of started to panic a little at her reaction. So then she like tried to calm down. And she's like, Dina, why are you eating a worm? And I said, well, it was laying on the sidewalk and it was all dry and the birds didn't want it. So I ate it. And like, I smiled and I had like little black pieces of worm in my teeth. And she was a little mortified. So
that was worth the segue here.
It's like my mom's
body's wiping her eye.
And she still sells it.
I remember in third grade reading a book called How to Eat Fried Worms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I remember that book.
Yeah.
I don't remember the book. I remember the
title. I didn't fry it. I just ate it. It was dry.
You were three. I mean, we do crazy things when we're three. I've got my parents have some stories they like to share about me when I was three and four that are pretty embarrassing. I personally, when it comes to worms, because my dad is a big fisherman, and it seems my kids are picking up where I left off. I used to play with the bait. So I would play with the leeches and I would tie the worms in knots.
Ew.
I mean, I was bored. I didn't have anything to do.
But when we were kids,
they're not blood-sucking leeches. The leeches you get for fishing are not bloodsuckers. So they can suction, but they're not sucking anything out of you. So
I used to go worm hunting with Grandpa Z when I was a kid. If it would rain, we'd put on our rain gear and get our little flashlights out, get our little bucket
crawlers,
and go out, get all the night crawlers out for so he could go fishing.
Yep, my dad did that when I was little too. I don't know if he still does, but he definitely did when we were little. My parents took the kids fishing in the summer and they sent me some pictures and it looks like they're doing exactly the same thing mommy did.
With the leeches, yep.
Yuck. Thanks on the leeches. The worms I can handle. I don't eat them anymore, but I can handle them.
Just leave that to the fish. But
I don't think I've ever touched a worm. Like, that just grosses me out.
I will share this. So we had some goldfish, if you will, and I went to go clean the tank one day, and when I dumped all the stuff out, there was a worm in there, and I was like, Donnie, why is there a worm in the fish tank? It's a goldfish, and you put this worm in there for it to eat. I'm like,
oh my gosh.
I'm like, it's not gonna eat.
I love it.
That's really cute though. That it was being so thoughtful.
So I feel bad though, because he basically drowned the worm.
But if fish eat worms, wouldn't his fish eat a worm?
Yeah, right. He's just trying to feed the fish.
It wasn't clarified as to what kind of a fish eats a worm. You know?
Yeah.
It's still a fish.
So, but that is our worm segment for today.
It's like the grasshopper thing that happened in Vegas in like 2014 something, where there was just like a billion grasshoppers everywhere. And watching video of that grossed me out so bad. Not like I am afraid of a grasshopper or something, but when there's a billion of them everywhere, it's a little much. Same thing with the worms. That would not have gone over well with me.
Oh, all right. Are you guys ready for the case for today?
Yes.
All right. So I actually listened to Dateline episode on this case just this past week. So it actually aired on Dateline on November 11th. So I listened to it on the podcast versus watching the actual Dateline episode, but just for awareness.
I didn't know this one because I think I'm all caught up on all my Datelines.
Yeah. So I've never heard of this case before. And so it is kind of an interesting one. So it's about a man named Ken Yeatus. So I made sure I wrote down how to pronounce the name because it's spelled J-U-E-D-E-S. So, but it's pronounced Yeatus.
Yeatus.
Yeatus. So, Kenneth Yeatus was born on March 20th, 1948, to Edwin and Margaret Yeatus. He was from Rothschild, Wisconsin. After graduating DC Everest High School, he went on to UW-Madison, Wisconsin, and earned a degree in pharmacology in 1972. Somewhere along the way, he married his first wife, and together they had four children. In the 1970s, he purchased the Dill Creek Farm, which is a 30-acre property in Unity, Wisconsin. So the purchase of Dill Creek Farm sparked a lifelong passion with the land. So he really enjoyed working the land and kind of being a bit of a hobby farmer, if you will. Ken planted hundreds of trees, and Dill Creek Farm became an actual certified tree farm. Ken was quite suited to farm life. In springtime, he made maple syrup, and he would start his garden. It was said that he grew some of the best peas and tomatoes around the area.
Ooh, fresh peas are so good.
Our kids actually love them.
Oh, fresh peas are just, they hit different.
Yeah, it's different than, I can't do cooked peas at all, but I can do fresh peas. In the fall, he would cut the winter wood. So he, you know, had his chores in the spring, summer, fall, and he didn't mind it by any means. He enjoyed that farm life. He was also a horse tamer and had four Belgian horses, and was a charter member of the Belgian Draft Horse Corporation of America. Photography was another thing that Ken enjoyed. He won first place honor for one of his pictures titled Road's End, which was displayed for many years at the Marshfield Clinic, and which he kept on display in his home. And he was also involved, so if he didn't have enough hobbies.
Right.
He was also involved with the car and motorcycle racing sport, so he was involved in motocross and was a big Harley fan. Each year, his Harley was loaded into the trailer, and Ken would make his pilgrimage to Elkhart Lake for the cycle show. So, big rider. Through his recreational motocross hobby, he became part owner of Monster Hall Raceway in Unity, Wisconsin as well. And so Monster Hall Raceway actually had ties to the Munsters, if you will, as in the show. So Eddie Munster, or the man who played Eddie Munster, who was a kid on the show back in the day, would actually go there for events and sign autographs and things like that as well.
And it's got to be, so I would assume that Unity is somewhere up near Wausau, since it's yes. He's got the painting at Marshfield Clinic, so I would assume it's somewhere yep. in that.
Yeah, vicinity. It's in the Wausau area. All right, so despite many years of a happy marriage with his first wife, they eventually drifted apart, partly due to Ken growing a bit restless in his middle age, so it seems... maybe that's just the nature of his personality with all the different hobbies, just
couldn't sit still.
Yeah. So they did end up getting divorced, which was kind of a new beginning for Ken, and I think also paved the way for him to really indulge in more of his hobbies. And at the time that they got divorced, three of their children were adults. So the oldest three were grown. But their youngest son was still a minor at the time, and so they ended up having joint custody of him. And it said that his son really liked spending time at the farm with his dad. So his son was just as happy with the farm life as his dad was. And initially the two shared a good relationship. In time, Ken did end up finding love again, this time with a woman named Cindy Schultz. And the two of them married in 2004. And so by all accounts, the two seemed to have obvious chemistry and enjoyed many adventures together. So people could say that you could just really see the connection between the two when they were together, and that Ken really adored his wife and would refer to her, call her beautiful, like as like a pet name. So, it, you know, it certainly seemed that he was happily married. The night of August 29th, 2006, Cindy Schultz-Yates was suffering a migraine. And to help ensure she was able to rest undisturbed, her pharmacist husband gave her some medicine and tucked her into bed in their camper located next to the house. So rather than, yeah. Is that
have
weird?
Everybody getting sick?
I don't know. I mean, it was a migraine, so I don't know that she would be able to pass it on to anybody else. I don't know if he was just thinking that she would be, you know, wouldn't have to worry about him moving around, disturbing her, or what. I mean, it still seems a little odd of why she wouldn't just be tucked into the house, like into bed in their house. But that
they were being really loud and she needed complete silence.
That's the story anyway. And while Cindy normally considered herself a light sleeper due to the medication that he had given her, that was not the case this night. So she was sleeping pretty soundly. When Cindy woke up the next morning, she said she heard a dog barking at the house. And so she headed over to kind of check it out and figure out what was going on. In entering the house, it appeared to Cindy that her husband, Ken, who should have been at work at that point in time, hadn't actually left yet. So she continued to walk through the house and kind of check it out, see if he was there looking for him. After walking through most of the house, she checked the bedroom and made a horrific discovery.
Oh, geez. I thought she was going to be the one that
same
murder, you know, in the
somebody came
something.
Into the camper and right. her.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yep. So Ken was still in bed. He was naked and he was covered in blood.
Mm.
So she did not approach his body to check on his condition or perform CPR. She immediately ran out of the house and tore out of the drive in the car to go to the nearest neighbor and have them call 911. So she claimed that the phone didn't work, and so she needed to go to the neighbors to have them call for help. And so she was able to relay, the neighbors were the ones that were actually on the phone with 911, and she relayed her comments through the neighbor describing the condition in which she had found her husband. So she actually went to one neighbor's house, had them call 911, and after that neighbor called 911, she left again and went to another neighbor and friend's house and kind of had them also call 911. So she was kind of all over the place. She would later describe herself as being in kind of a trance-like state, saying that it was like she was floating above herself. And she would say that she heard screaming and only later realized that it was her that was screaming.
Oh, wow.
When investigators arrived on scene to investigate, they not only discovered Ken in the condition that Cindy had described, but they also discovered a note with the word bitch stabbed into the pillow next to Ken's body.
Wait.
Huh.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So This begged the question of who was the actual intended target. Was it Ken or was it Cindy?
I think it's kind of obvious to see, even if a man is in bed, that it's not a woman.
Yeah, but it could have been like a message to her. You know, and after this, because it was something that they were legitimately like, were they both intended to be killed? Was it really her and they ended up killing him? Or what? She actually did suffer a lot of paranoia after this, and still, like, she just didn't feel safe. Like, there were times where she would actually have what ended up being false alarms, but she would call the police and, like, freaking out, thinking that somebody had broken into her house or that she wasn't safe. But it was definitely something that was taken seriously as a consideration in trying to figure out who could have done this, was whether or not they actually meant to harm Cindy. Maybe it was an enemy of hers. So investigation ultimately determined that Ken had been murdered, a result of two gunshot wounds to the chest caused by a 20-gauge shotgun.
Wow.
So shot, but yet he also had a knife.
Well, the knife was in the pillow.
Through the note.
Well, right, right. I'm saying, but he brought a knife to the party too, right?
Well,
have it in the pillow.
It's a possibility. I mean,
could have been a house knife.
Okay.
Yeah. But also, too, it would
be bringing a shotgun. Even, I mean, not like a small gun, like a big gun.
There's also, I mean, you could, I mean, naturally one would assume that the note likely has something to do with the crime or was brought to the party by the whoever perpetrated the crime of murdering him. But
I
you
like
also,
that you're both using the phrase brought to the party.
Yes, but
not a party I want to attend.
No, exactly. But no, the other thing that you can't necessarily rule out is maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe there is an entirely different reason for that note to be present at the scene. We just don't know. So it does, I mean, the likelihood of it probably seems pretty slim, but you, as an investigator, you got to try and go into it with an open mind.
Eyes wide open.
Naturally, the so no small task. The police had to figure out who could possibly want to kill Ken and why, if he, in fact, was the intended target. So naturally, the first place police looked was Cindy as the spouse. So not only as a potential suspect, but also to find out what she knew about any potential enemies, both of Ken and potentially of herself. Surprisingly, Cindy seemed to point in the direction of her youngest stepson, the son with whom Ken still shared custody with his ex-wife.
Oh, my gosh, how old is he?
16.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so he was 16 at the time that his father was murdered. According to Cindy, Ken had gifted her a 20-gauge shotgun, which coincidentally matches the gauge of the murder weapon, which she said had been taken by her stepson. So she said that he stole it or what, but she said that he had taken her gun. Additionally, her husband and his son currently had a bit of a rocky relationship. None of Ken's kids seemed to like Cindy, and in fact referred to her as the bitch.
And just like the note said.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be a lovely
family.
Yeah.
Household, so, my gosh.
Well, I don't know how much the older kids, I take this with a grain of salt in context of the larger story, but there was an obituary that was posted for Ken that I found, and it appears to me that it was written by Cindy, so perhaps more one-sided of the story, if you will. But it indicates in there that he hadn't had contact with any of his biological children for a year prior to his death. But
this is in the obituary?
Oh.
Stop. Oh my God.
That's and weird. It lists survived by
he was a shitty father. Like, what the heck?
Yeah. No. Well, and it lists that he is survived by like loving daughters or whatever, and it lists three of them, but I believe they're his stepdaughters. It doesn't actually name his biological children.
Wow.
Oh, come on. That's shitty.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. So none of the kids liked her.
Petty.
Yeah. And this was especially true of the youngest son. And tensions had reached a peak when his son arrived for a scheduled stay at his dad's to find Cindy in front of the house with his things packed in garbage bags, saying that he was no longer welcome to stay there.
Wow.
So his mom drove him there to drop him off for a scheduled visit with his dad. And I don't think his dad was there, but Cindy was there with all his stuff packed in bags and was like, you can go home with your mom.
She is a bitch.
I was just going to say, Cindy is sounding like a biatch.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know what could have possibly prompted that, but that seems, I mean, it was a devastating blow for him who, you know, even if he doesn't like her, still likes his dad and wants to have a relationship with him. So, I don't know. Any suspicion of Ken's children would ultimately prove to be false, as they all had alibis, including his youngest son, who was home with his mother and sisters at the time of the crime. So he had, I mean, and it's stronger than just being like, oh yeah, it's my mom, because there were three people that could corroborate the story. And, you know, likely during the interviewing, they would have interviewed them separately and made sure their stories matched. So they're able to verify that it's not just them covering for him or anything like that.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like the kids would have much motive to kill him anyway.
I think that kind of falls into the, well, maybe they really went there intending to get Cindy, because there's a note stabbed into the pillow that said bitch. So maybe she was really the one that was supposed to be killed. And I think that's kind of the narrative that she, at least initially, was kind of sticking to. And so additionally, despite the current state of his relationship with his dad, his son did love him and hoped that they would be able to repair their relationship in time. So, I mean, he was only 16, had plenty of time, he thought, at least. And then now his dad's murdered, and any hope of them being able to repair their relationship is just gone. Not to mention, he's like in the middle of his teen years, which is already tough enough as it is, trying to navigate this divorce and remarriage. And then, I mean, talk about trauma on trauma. So, but there was no love lost between Ken's children and Cindy. And despite police ruling them out as suspects, Cindy still felt that they could have been responsible. And she actually removed their pictures from Ken's home within days of his murder.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wait, this is really a step monster. The definition of a step monster.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you have children of your own, you'd think you'd be a little bit more empathetic with them. But whatever.
She sounds like kind of a shitty human in general.
Mm-hmm. Investigators also found evidence of others with motive to want Ken Yedis dead. Ken Yedis had sued a man for fraud on the land where the Monster Hall Raceway was that he co-owned. The accusation was that the land was advertised and sold at a higher value than it was actually worth. And due to this, Ken and the co-owners at the Monster Hall Raceway were losing money. So there is some financial motive there as well, that his finances seem to be suffering at least a little bit, or aren't as stable as they could be because of his co-ownership and investment in this Monster Hall Raceway, because it was advertised as being worth more than what it actually was. So this lawsuit was actually for $300,000. So it was a $300,000 financial lawsuit against Randall Landwehr. And had actually closed, so that the suit had gone through to completion with Randall losing. So it closed out in favor of Ken Yedis in the spring of 2006. So a few months before his murder. But Kenyatta said also worked to file for criminal charges involving the Clark County Sheriff's Office to investigate the same fraud claim. And that investigation was still active at the time of his death. So in addition to the financial side, he was also looking for punishment from like a criminal side as well. And so that was still pending. So $300,000 is a lot of money and certainly cause for motive. But there ultimately was no evidence to support that Randall Landwehr or any of the investors who in Landwehr's brewery business and who lost money as a result of the lawsuit had anything to do with Ken's death. And then, interestingly enough, one of the investors that came under suspicion during the investigation was none other than Butch Patrick Lilly, most known as Eddie Munster from the Munsters. So I kind of mentioned earlier that he was connected to the Munster Hall Raceway, but it turns out he was also, and I don't know if it was so much him as it was his mom, but they were investors in this Randall Landwehr's brewery. And so when this Randall lost that financial lawsuit, they essentially lost their investment in this brewery. And so he was looked at as like a potential suspect because of this, because he lost money as a result of this. And he had become acquainted with Ken at the Munster Hall Raceway from the times that he would come and sign autographs. So he was aware of, or at least familiar with Ken, but I don't think they were particularly like close. They're more just acquaintances.
I love that he would come and sign autographs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I was just gonna say, I would think that there would be some like Munster money left, but you think of like the old, you know, this was black and white. I think that's the Munster one, where, you know, not a newer one. So I don't think that they had like a whole lot of stuff in contracts regarding syndication, because there was not going to be such a thing as syndication. And that's where a lot of these people make most of their money. And
he was a
child actor. I don't know how many years the show went on, but so yeah, he may have really needed that money that he lost.
And well, and I don't know that he did a whole lot after that, but it did. Yeah. I found an article that said that his mom had invested $10,000, which, I mean, yes, it would really be unfortunate to lose $10,000. But in the grand scheme of things, like, is that
it's not worth enough money?
Right. Exactly. I think it was just that he was connected to it. There was some notoriety associated with that. And I mean, money is always, I mean, people have killed for less. It has happened, but it doesn't seem to be like that would really be enough of a motive. But I think the thought really wasn't so much that he on his own did it. I think it was more that this group of guys, who including Randall and Butch Patrick Lilly, who collectively lost money as a result of the lawsuit, together plotted to murder Ken Yidis. And kind of to go with that, there was a rather bizarre part of the story with that motive. And that was, there was an individual who had come forward to investigators with the story of having overheard a group of men at a bar discussing the murder of Ken. And part of the story included the fact that Ken, who was a pharmacist, sometimes sold illegal drugs, including cocaine. And supposedly Ken had taken some of the individuals of, you know, from that group to his home to buy cocaine that evening.
What the heck? A pharmacist who deals drugs?
Right. I mean, I'm sure it happens, but like, I don't think they ever found any. But anyway, yeah. So I don't know if it's actually true that he sold cocaine. But that's kind of what the story was that this guy was saying, was that he sometimes sold cocaine. And so there would be groups, you know, these, some of these guys would be coming over to his house. So they're familiar with where he lived. And that they supposedly that day that he died, that one of those individuals was this Butch Patrick Lilly, had gone over there to buy drugs. It did come out when this would eventually make it to trial, this Eddie Munster, Butch Patrick Lilly, did testify, did get called to testify. And he did admit that he did occasionally do cocaine. Sad, but not terribly shocking for a celebrity. But I don't know that he ever said that he purchased cocaine at any point in time from Ken. So they were never able to corroborate the details of this story. So it's just some story that some guy told. And it's unclear why this individual would have fabricated that story. It also came to light during the investigation that Cindy and Ken were known to take in foster children in their home. While Cindy was unable to connect with her stepchildren, she was thought to be a very caring and nurturing person who loved taking care of others, at least if you ask her sister Pam.
Yeah, I'm like, what a slap in the face to the stepkids. Like, yeah. You hate us and we're not good enough for you, but now you're going to try and look all lovey-dovey and generous.
If you're a super caring person, you don't hate your husband's four kids.
Yeah.
Exactly. Bottom line.
Yeah.
Well, and in listening to her sister Pam talk through the Dateline episode, she's very loyal to her sister. She obviously loves her sister very much, so she's very much on her side. So, like, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But she also, and, like, I don't know her. I haven't seen the Dateline episode. I'm just going based off of the snippets that I'm hearing in the podcast episode from the interviews, but it doesn't seem like she's the sharpest tool in the shed, which is a terrible thing to say, but I can see where she's kind of got that blind loyalty and she may be putting blinders on to obvious things and just kind of taking her sister's word for things or failing to see the bad in people that she knows and cares about.
Well, and often if she's hearing just her sister's side of things, I'm sure the sister is probably saying all sorts of terrible things that the kids are doing or saying.
Right.
And if that's the case, you're of course going to be like, wow, that sucks. These kids are awful. Like, you're so wonderful. I'm sorry you have to deal with this. I think that kind of would be the way that it would be.
Yeah, and I think the kids that they would take in were largely teenagers when they would bring them in. And I mean, that's always a difficult age to be fostering as well. So at the time of the homicide, they had no current foster placements and were not expecting any new placements. But Cindy did say that they were potentially expecting one of their former foster kids to come over that night. So apparently her migraine that evening wasn't the first that she was feeling bad. She'd been kind of feeling off that whole week, it sounds like. And so she had, it said she told her boss. So I wonder if she's worked within the foster care system in some way. But she did indicate not to have any placements during that time period because she wasn't feeling well.
Or because she was planning her husband's murder.
Could be.
I mean, just taking a little stab at that.
Yeah. So at the it seems kind of vague the way that she says it's like they didn't have any placements, they weren't expecting any, but there was a chance that one of their foster kids could be coming over. But due to her being asleep in the camper, she was unable to say whether or not that had actually happened. And another thing I would note is that Cindy gave different names of the foster kid at different interviews. So the kid that she said when she was initially interviewed was different than the name and the kid that she said was supposed to come over later on. So her story changed, which is never a good sign.
Always a red flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, the foster kids they took in often had rough backgrounds, which could lead to their capability of committing such a crime. So it's another avenue that they have to investigate. Could one of the foster kids have a beef with Ken that they would want to potentially kill him? But ultimately this led to another dead end in the investigation. So while we haven't really talked about her directly in terms of motive, we have certainly been talking a bit about Cindy. So let's talk a little bit more about her. First of all, when Cindy discovered Ken's bloodied body, she did not attempt to give him CPR, and she didn't even go to his body to confirm he had a pulse. She admitted she did not touch him at all. She just saw him and left. And now
she knew he was dead. Because would she be.
So
I wish the listeners could have seen your face as you said that, because it was pretty funny. She got all big, like squinty eyed.
Now, while everyone is trained, not everyone is trained in CPR. So if you don't know how to do CPR, you might be doing more harm than good potentially. Although in these types of emergency situations, they usually encourage people to attempt it.
Just remember, staying alive.
Stay alive. Stay alive.
That's your beat. You're supposed to do 2 pumps per second. 120 beats a minute.
So there is the excuse, or could have been the excuse, for someone if they didn't know how to do CPR, if they were worried that they would do more damage. That is actually not true of Cindy, as she had CPR training due to her duties as a foster parent. Mm-hmm. And it was even marked on her calendar that she had just attended another CPR training just 2 weeks before Ken was murdered. Cindy told investigators that she saw his chest move as if he was breathing. And so her focus was on getting out and getting help. Not to mention, as I said earlier, that she kind of described herself as being in like a trance-like state. So she was in such a state of shock that she wasn't like...
That she drove her car.
Through yeah, the, yeah,
Cindy's looking a little shady to me.
Couldn't make a phone call, but she could drive her car.
Yeah, so she tried, now she said she tried 2 separate landline phones in the house, but that apparently they weren't working, and so then it was at that point that she drove off to a neighbor's to call for help, and so she only tried the landline phones, but she did have a cell phone, which did work in various points of the house. I don't know if it was perfect cell service, because it's podunk Unity. But she didn't even try to use her cell phone. She didn't even attempt it. She tried the landlines, didn't try her cell phone, just bounced. And I remember 2006, that's about the time period where cell phones are still for emergency use for the most part, but they're starting to gain popularity. So, I mean, what other emergency do you got than your husband bloodied and
anyway. So, like, you probably had to pay 25 cents to make the call at that point. It wasn't like now, but still. It's faster than driving to the neighbor's house.
Right. After the murder, Cindy completely cut off contact with Ken's family, and not just his children. Ken's mother only learned of what had happened to her son after being visited and notified by the police.
No.
What? Oh,
yeah. So the news did not come from Cindy. According to her sister, Pam, her ardent supporter, that was because Cindy didn't want to tell her over the phone. She wanted her to be told in person. So she thought it was best that the police tell her in person.
Oh, Cindy.
Oh, she couldn't drive him.
What did you say, Terry?
Is it, where did the mother live that she couldn't get in a car and drive there?
In the same area?
Like, oh, my God.
Cindy also ignored repeated calls and messages from Ken's mother and sister. And it should be noted that Ken was considered to be a bit of a mama's boy. So had a very good relationship with his mom, loved his mom. And they were calling to ask about, there was some land that had been deeded to him. It was family land. They were asking a little bit about that. But the main thing that they were trying to contact her about was plans for his burial and what they're going to do for the funeral. Because his mother was a devout Catholic and she already had a burial plot for Ken as a result of this. And she just wanted to make sure that he was properly laid to rest. Cindy basically never called them back. She just completely ignored repeated calls and messages and just never even contacted them. Eventually, they found out that Ken was to be cremated, which goes against what his mother at least wanted. And while they don't know for certain whether or not that was Ken's wishes to be cremated, they did find it hard to believe that he wouldn't cater to what his mom's wishes were. So, I mean, one thing people probably aren't even really thinking about going before your parents. But they're like, even if he had wanted to be cremated, if he died and his mom was still alive and she wanted him buried, they said Ken would probably let her just bury him because it was his mom and he loved her and would give her what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then also too, so in addition to him being cremated, Cindy didn't provide any of his remains to his parents, although she did admit that she gave some of his ashes to friends of theirs.
What?
Yeah, this lady's wackadoo.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think she had a bad relationship with her mother-in-law either. So it's just like, what the heck? It sounds like the sister never really liked her, but she lived in a completely different part of the country, so it's not like they interacted all that often. I guess the first time that they actually had any interaction was over the phone, and Cindy was going on and on about how they had gotten married in Vegas and blah blah blah. And they did eventually get married, and I believe they got married in Vegas, but at the time they hadn't been married yet, and the sister knew that and like called her out on it on the phone, like, why are you talking about being married? You're not married yet. And like she said it was like the flick of a switch. It was like talking to a completely different person after she called her out, and she just went from sweet and sugary to just, you know, Cindy.
Dang.
A psycho killer.
Mm-hmm. So also, as I stated, that the obituary, which I took with a grain of salt, definitely appears to have been written by Cindy, because it does talk about his parents. It does mention his biological children, doesn't name the biological children, and doesn't list them as those being survived by him, and says that they were, although they hadn't been in contact for a year before his murder, that they were... I forget exactly how it says it, but that they were like dear to Ken's heart or whatever, which, yeah, okay, he's their father. Of course he loves them.
Right. Why wouldn't you mention them,
yeah? Right.
Seriously. Like, he's got four children that you don't identify in his obituary.
It's very weird. It's so weird. And then, but she also had a separate memorial service for Ken. So his family, including his parents, had their own service for him, and she had hers.
Damn.
So weird. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
And so bizarre. And when a will was eventually discovered, it was found that everything was left to Cindy. Ken's children had been completely cut out.
Oh my gosh.
Further investigation into the will would find that the man who had witnessed Ken's signature on the document, who signed it himself as well, said that no such thing had occurred and that his own signature had been forged.
Wait, on the will document?
Yeah, so the guy who's supposed wow. who had this was signed as like the witness, he was like, yeah, uh-huh. I didn't sign that.
Oh my god.
And he said the man worked with Ken and stated that based on the date and like the timing of the signatures, he said that the two of them would have been at work at that time.
Oh, so he's like, there's absolutely no possible way that I could have been there to do this.
Like, well, it's like, first of all, I definitely didn't sign this, and then I don't even think Ken did it, because we would have been at work when this was done. Like, I don't think this is legit. So handwriting analysis indicated that it was possible that Ken's signature had been forged. Yep. And it would come out that Cindy, who kind of managed like the household finances, would it was not uncommon for her to sign checks in Ken's name. So she was adept at signing his signature on things. Important things as well. So part of the estate that Cindy inherited included 80 acres of family land that had been deeded to Ken by his parents. And this was one of the things that they had called her about in the wake of his murder to kind of find out like what was going to happen to this family land, probably because they wanted to make sure that it stayed in the family. But Cindy, who ignored their calls, actually had the property up for sale within 20 days of Ken's murder.
Oh, sheesh. Red flags all over the place.
Money grabbing. Biatch.
Yep. And then there's the matter of life insurance benefits. So Cindy was estimated to gain up to $1 million in life insurance. And one State Farm policy alone netted her a cool $285,000. Now, this is where her being used to signing his names on things like checks, you know, laying the groundwork for it not being an uncommon thing for her to do. Cindy admitted that she signed Ken's name in 2005 on a change of beneficiary policy where she would get 75% of the benefits and one of his children would get 25% in the event of his death. Though she said that she only would have signed it with his permission or under his direction.
Why would he have signed it himself?
That would be a good question. But her interest in his benefits stemmed beyond those in which she was a beneficiary. On September 13, 2006, she also called National Mutual Benefit about a policy in which Edwin Yedis, Ken's father, was the beneficiary, requesting that they send the claim form to her so that she could help Margaret and Edwin fill it out, even though she wasn't answering their repeated calls in the wake of Ken's death.
Oh, geez.
And when she was asked about this, she didn't recall that.
I'm sure not. She was probably in a trance-like state.
Now, this part, it's hard when you're reading or hearing about these details because we're not investigators or, like, lawyers, so we look at things from a different perspective. We're kind of...
I don't know. I would look at things like an investigator and a lawyer half the time, I think.
Well, so here's part here. So while plenty of suspicion abounded in the case of Ken Yedis' murder, solid evidence was hard to come by, and it remained largely circumstantial. So everything we've talked about really sounds damning, but none of it is, like, concrete. It's all circumstantial evidence. Despite investigators never considering the case a cold case, it did remain officially unsolved with no arrests for 13 years.
Ooh. Come on. Oh, my yep. gosh.
Wow. Yes.
So she was smarter than we're all giving her credit for.
It was, all right? It was all circumstantial. They didn't have a slam dunk. They never found the gun. DNA evidence never yielded anything.
Wow.
Even with the advancements in technology, they didn't have witnesses. Like, it was like... Yeah, so, but...
In double jeopardy, you don't want to rush to trial if you're not pretty sure that you're actually going to get a conviction when you think that somebody is the actual killer. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
wait until you can definitely get them.
And that is a great way to look at it, but it is interesting how this all unfolded. So, on November 27, 2019, more than 13 years after the shooting, Cindy was arrested and charged with murder. So the question would be, what changed to finally bring this case to trial? Like, were they more sure now than they were before? The answer is nothing changed.
Wow.
Whoa.
Nothing actually changed. The case was nearly 100% circumstantial. In the 13 years of investigation and new investigators on the case over the years, no new evidence was unearthed. Even advancements in investigative technology and DNA didn't lead to anything new. in the end, it came down to having a prosecutor who was willing to take the case to court, and the simple fact that this was as good as the case was going to get.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose at a certain point you're like, all right, well, at least I'd rather try for it. And if she isn't convicted, all right, at least we tried versus she's been running around for 13 years.
So
and potentially could do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Black Widow.
They essentially stated that this was as good as it's going to get. It wasn't going to get any stronger, and it would likely only get weaker as their witnesses aged and memories faded.
Yeah, that's true.
The suspicion of Cindy Schultzidis was present with investigators from the beginning of the investigation. It was believed that Ken was murdered in his own bed, in his own home, while he slept. And while she stated that the doors were unlocked that evening, there was ultimately no sign of forced entry. So maybe that was true. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe she just was able to get into the house because she did it. Ultimately, too, she stood to gain the most from his death. Like, she got everything. She got the benefits. She got his estate. Like, his kids got completely cut out of everything. So when it came to trial, prosecution kind of painted the picture that Cindy had found the goose that laid the golden egg when she met Ken Yidis.
Dang.
Thanks to handwriting analysis. Now here's a good kicker. This goes back to the beginning here. It is also believed that the note with the word bitch stabbed into Cindy's pillow might have actually been written by Ken.
Or she forged it because she forges her stuff or his stuff.
Well, they reference in the Dateline episode that he had a very specific way of writing his B's and that it looked like he had actually done it himself. So their theory was that the two of them had been arguing, that something like tipped him over the edge and he was like pissed off at her
and maybe gonna divorce her and
or something
quickly. Yeah,
or I don't know, that they were arguing that he wrote that note and in his anger stabbed it into the pillow because it was her pillow on her side of the bed. And that maybe that's why she was sleeping in the camper that night. Not because she had a migraine, but because they're pissed off at each other and couldn't be in the same house. And that, you know, just as he lost it with her, she lost it with him. And her response was to get her 20-gauge shotgun and shoot him.
Or she kept the note after he wrote it and then placed it and stabbed it into the pillow as a oh my gosh, what if I had been in there? It could have been both of us.
Could have been that too. But so it painted the picture that things may not have been as rosy between the two of them as it appeared to be if he did in fact write that note, and that there could have been a different reason for her being in the camper that night, which honestly would make a hell of a lot more sense than her just having a migraine. Like, that doesn't make sense. Cindy pled not guilty and took her chances on a trial. Unfortunately, the prosecution were able to take their fortunately for everyone else, the prosecution were able to take their circumstantial case and convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that she was responsible for the murder of her husband, as she was found guilty in October of 2021 of first degree intentional homicide after 5 hours of deliberation.
Yay.
Wow, nice.
Pretty quick for a murder trial.
Yeah. On June 8th, 2022, so earlier this year, a now 67-year-old Cindy was sentenced to life in prison without parole. And she is currently incarcerated at Tachita Correctional Institution in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Tachita.
So I was going to ask the question of, like, whether you guys think she did it, but I'm pretty sure you guys all do. So.
Oh, hell yeah, she did it.
There's enough circumstantial evidence there. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, there is some belief, even by his sister, that while she believes that she did it or that she was involved, at least his sister does believe that there may have been other people involved that kind of got off the hook. So that maybe she was in cahoots potentially with like the, I don't know if it would be the same group of people that she kind of highlighted as like the
druggies
on the other side of the, well, in the lawsuit.
No. Okay.
It was in a lawsuit, or maybe she had foster kids in on it. Who knows? God forbid that she be such a corrupt individual that she got foster children involved in it. But
I feel like if she like knew of or could prove that anybody else was a part of this in any way, shape, or form, she would have thrown them under the bus, because she was throwing everybody under the bus all the way
around,
that's true.
So
I think,
you know, her excuse of not being in the house when all of this happened in the grand scheme of things is just a bit too convenient.
Yeah, I think that her plan A was to pin it on the stepson. And that didn't pan out. And so then she had to backtrack and try to come up with other people to pin it on.
Yeah. And she did a good enough job that it took 13 years till they brought her in.
And that's just terrible. I mean, who wants to pin a murder on a 16-year-old kid?
Right?
She's an evil woman. Or evil human.
And even if he had taken the shotgun, like she said, because he had an alibi, he probably would have just turned it over to the police.
Right.
Yeah, like they never found
it.
They never found it. That gun was like missing to this day. Like they never found it because they were never able to find the actual murder weapon, even knowing that she had a weapon that matched the, like they were never able to locate it to rule it out. So, I mean, that alone is suspicious. That tells you that that weapon for sure was the murder weapon. It's just who held it. When it, I mean, was it her or was it somebody that she got to do it for her? You know, I don't know.
Going with her. I think they got the right person. Well, I was wrong, too. I just looked up my Dateline episodes and I have not caught up on this.
Yeah, so this I mean
31 episode 9, The Trouble at Dill Creek Farm.
Yep,
so
The Trouble. Yep. Yeah, so I would highly encourage anyone who's interested in learning more about the crimes to listen to the Dateline episode either on the podcast or watch it on television, as both are available. It should have aired on November 11th.
Yep.
So it's out there for you. It's got Andrea Canning, and she does a great job. Obviously, I didn't touch on all the details, and they got all the fun interviews with people. So it's, and I love listening to Dateline. So I definitely encourage everyone to do that as well. But yeah, so thanks to Dateline for bringing that case to my attention that I had not heard of, for sure. So hopefully it seems that justice prevailed in that case.
Definitely.
I mean, always times where you just never know, but it's a lot of not so good looks for Miss Cindy Schultz-Edis.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, you guys ready for the Wisco high note?
Yes.
All righty. So looking ahead, as for when this podcast will air, I found it's appropriate for the holiday season as we're entering into, like, Thanksgiving is literally in a couple of days and Christmas is around the corner, and the way that this year is gone, it's going to be here like next hour. So I found it's a Festival of Trees hosted by the National Railroad Museum. And it runs from November 17th through December 31st of this year. So the Festival of Trees, featuring dozens of uniquely decorated trees prominently displayed among our historic locomotives and exhibits, enchants more than 20,000 visitors each holiday season. This year, our Festival of Trees runs from November 17th through December 31st. We are grateful for all of the businesses and organizations that have provided tree sponsorships Their support is instrumental in helping grow the museum and our educational mission. And then it does say, please note the museum is closed on Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and New Year's Eve, where it closes at 2 p.m. during the Festival of Trees experience. The museum also closes earlier on days that the Polar Express train ride is scheduled in November and December. So if you have kids that love trains, and also if you and or you love Christmas, this seems like a really great thing. I feel like our kids would love it. It would totally be worth the trip just to take them to the National Railroad Museum and
Green Bay
trees. Right? Yeah. So this is in, yes, it's Green Bay, Wisconsin. So it, for us, at least it's, you know, hour and a half or 2 hour hike to get up there, but totally worth it. I think for our kids love trains. We love going to see different light shows this time of year with the holidays. And that's essentially what this looks like. It is. It's just a bunch of different Christmas trees decorated with different themes right up next to all these trains and locomotives. And it's looks like a lot of fun.
Pretty cool.
Yep. So that runs through the end of the year. I can see. Let me just see how expensive it is. So yeah, it's not even that expensive at all. So daily admission tickets, it says $12 for adults, and that's 13 and older. $8 for children ages 2 to 12, and then children under the age of 2 are free. And $10 for seniors ages 62 and older. If you are a member by chance, it is free as well. And then if you do want to do a train ride, in addition to regular admission, it's $3. So that's like hardly anything.
Gotta do that train ride.
I was really gonna say, yeah, gotta do a train ride.
So yeah, I mean, I would think so. The kids would totally get a kick out of that.
You're already there.
Yeah, completely. So, and it says April through December hours are Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sundays from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. And then they also have Polar Express train ride event this time of year as well.
I have a friend who did that and she said it was amazing, but I guess it's super duper hard to get tickets. Super hard.
I would think because it probably is like really cool. In demand.
Yeah, so I'm just clicking on this. So for anybody that's interested in the Polar Express train ride, it says tickets for all shows in 2022 are sold out. So
yep, there you have it.
I know when we did the Santa Cruise with Ava, we had to book them like in October, like at the beginning of October.
Yeah. Wow. The Lake Geneva cruise. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
It does look like it's a shorter run too for the Polar Express train ride. That's November 18th through the 11th. So it's only maybe a month or a couple weekends. But for future years, if it's something that you might be interested in, it says the National Railroad Museum will present the Polar Express train ride on select dates between November 18th and December 11, 2022. The Polar Express has become a time-honored holiday tradition for people throughout Wisconsin and beyond. The tickets for all 40 shows, 12,000 plus seats in 2022, went on sale in July 25th and sold out in less than one day.
Wow. You're not kidding, Jill.
Hard yeah, you have to have that on your radar, on your calendar, set aside.
Like, first thing in the morning, get online and book it.
Yeah.
Holy cow. It says, the Polar Express is a magical recreation of the classic children's story. Following the original book and movie, you will be immersed in the Polar Express story. When you arrive at the museum, you will enter a Lenfesti Center. Before the show, you are welcome to stroll among the decorated trees and the Festival of Trees, explore the full-size trains, or play reindeer games. The show begins with the hot chocolate dance, after which we all sip a cup of hot chocolate. Next, we listen to a dramatic reading of the original Polar Express book. Our conductor then calls all aboard, inviting guests to ride the Polar Express to the North Pole. On board a real moving train, our adventure continues as you interact with the characters from the story. This is not a train ride where you will see holiday decorations every inch of the way. Instead, we will travel through cold, dark forests, encounter a hobo, view the northern lights, and see polar bears in the Arctic Circle. Santa will visit with some of the passengers aboard the train. Once we arrive at the North Pole, those who did not visit with Santa on the train will have time to see him before he heads around the world on Christmas Eve. So that sounds like a truly magical experience.
Yes, that's what I've heard. It's just amazing, magical. If you see the movie, they said it's right out of the movie book. And I think my girlfriend, the whole family wore like PJ pants and really so got crazy. Into it.
I did see the movie and it is very cute.
Yeah, I think that might have to be something that unless you
put on your calendar
right,
in July.
Like, seriously, yeah. I would think that that would be like, considering how popular it is, it'd be kind of like a once in a lifetime experience for the kids, and
absolutely.
Something that you want to get while they're still interested in that kind of thing.
Well, all right, Aunt Terry, make it happen.
And the boys will be on a train next Sunday, the 27th. It's a Christmas train. It's with East Troy Electric Railroad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? You guys are doing that? Is it a dinner thing or a lights thing or what?
It's a break
for mom and dad.
Ride will take you from our East Troy depot to Santa's workshop located at the Elegant Farmer. Here, children can visit Santa, take a photo with the jolly elf himself. The trolleys will be heated and bathrooms are available. The total experience is 2 hours in duration, consisting of 30 minutes on the train to the Elegant Farmer. And then we can stop at the Elegant Farmer and do some, they can meet with Santa and we can walk around the Elegant Farmer. So
they'll be like, I want this. I want that. Give me a caramel apple. Give me an apple pie. Like
Bonnie can buy some Wisconsin products.
Exactly. Yes.
They have good popcorn. But yeah. So, well, thank you all for listening to our episode today. I hope you enjoyed the story, and I also hope that you check out the Dateline episode, because definitely worth the listen. Nobody does it like Dateline, that is for sure. But we'll catch you in a couple weeks, I believe. And until next time, eat, drink, and be wary.
Thank you for listening to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. We would like to also thank the references that make this podcast possible. A full list of references can be found on our website at beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at beercheeseandmurderpod, where pictures from today's episode are available for your viewing. If you would like to share your feedback, Wisco facts, case suggestions, stories, or just whatever, please email us at contact@beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Don't forget to tell your friends, but most importantly, until next time, eat, drink, and be wary.